Yeah, this is fun. This is good. It's good content right here.
I'm sure we're gonna keep this in.
Yeah, when we talked about doing a podcast together, I was hoping we could get some footage of you cleaning up your dog's pee on the floor.
Cue the open music. There he is. So, we're working on this project, and I can't even talk about the project. I can't even say what's on these tapes that I was looking for. I can't even say who's on those tapes because as soon as I say it, you'll know.
I see your mic lighting up red, like maybe you're a little too,
Yeah,
like you're
like
too
it's
hot.
no, it's I
What?
don't think it's I think
Watch,
it's the
yell into
light.
it. Yell into your mic. Close.
Check.
See that red dot flashing?
Yeah. Is that no good?
I'm just letting you know you've peaked a little bit a couple of times already.
I'm so excited about this episode. So today we have on Vivian. She's a producer. She stayed at my house. You met her the other day because she her and her husband were staying at my house because they had a film that was in South by Southwest. We'll let her explain this, but she has one of my favorite documentaries of all time, which is Pepsi, Where's My Jet? Did you watch it?
I did. Watched all four episodes.
What did you think?
So I liked it a lot. I thought it was very cool. I had no idea a lot of that stuff played out or how some of that stuff happened. There was, of course, the sense of nostalgia that got,
Yes,
came
they
up.
do such a good job with the sense of nostalgia.
Yeah, I love that piece. There have been a lot of things I've watched recently. I mean, I think it's by design that all the nostalgia things are coming up right now because of the generation we are that they're keen toward, right?
Yeah.
But the nostalgia stuff, man, lately more than ever has really been making me like emotionally attached to things, or like when I remember a thing, like, oh, I forgot about that piece, or like whatever that is, I was like, it like takes me back, gives me this very
Yeah.
visceral feeling associated with it. So I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Did you ever do the Pepsi trying to get the points?
Yes, but I don't know that I ever. No, I don't know if Pepsi. We did the Mountain Dew one. I remember that one a lot. I remember cashing in some of the Mountain Dew stuff, but that was later. It wasn't during the Pepsi stuff.
Anyway, so she's going to be on today. Excited to talk to her.
How did you feel about the Pepsi thing? So you always ask me questions, you answer, then you just go on to the next thing. You never
Yep.
like, like I'm the one being interviewed.
Here's one of the things that I like. When they did that transition from him, the older guy sitting in the chair, to when he was young, and
Yeah.
that dude looks a lot like me when he was young.
Yeah.
Scrawny. I had that same
You
shirt.
shirt. I thought the same
Yeah,
thing when I saw
they
it. I go,
did.
I Sikalski had that shirt.
I want to know sort of the backstory on that. I would love to know how that came about, because that is, that's a heavy lift. You're going against Pepsi.
Yeah, agreed. I found the whole thing very intriguing.
It was also too a David versus Goliath story, which I always love those kind of things.
For sure. Yeah, that'd be exciting to dive into.
But I do want to dive into with Vivian so we're talking about the Anti-Social Network on Netflix, and if you watch it, if you haven't watched it, watch it. But it is so eye-opening how, when you connect the dots, how we got to 4chan to January 6th. And this is not a political show, so we're not going to say like what our thoughts are on January. Obviously, January 6th was horrible stain on our nation. I don't think that's a controversial thing to say, that you probably shouldn't be smashing in the windows, and I don't think that's
Depends on who
controversial.
you're
But
asking.
even the people on both sides can at least agree that violence is not the way. Can we just have a starting point of there, maybe? Here we go.
What I know is
We just started civil war.
yes, you just launched into political stuff.
Why do you think it was right for them to go into there? Here we
I do
go.
not.
Dude, Eric, why weren't you there, by the way? You said you
Wow,
missed the
man.
flight.
Wow, man. After we visit my defining moment about me being a convicted felon, it'll answer
It'll
itself.
answer itself why you were not at January 6th. Are you ready for the Vivian interview?
Ebb and flow, here we go.
Vivian, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Good. It is a long time no see. What is it? 2 weeks now?
I know. it's been about like a month. About like, yeah.
Has it been a month?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Time flies. Can you tell us why you're at my house? Before we even get that. Why don't we take a step back? Why don't you tell us what you do? Like kind of give us your 30-second background.
Okay. Well, my name is Vivian Johnson Rogowski. I live in Los Angeles, California, and I work for a production company called North of Now. And I am a producer and a development executive.
Well done.
You didn't always want to do this, right? Or maybe you did always want to do it, but the path that you took was not like go to film school and then get a job producing or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's more like I just was always on a journey of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Like I, you know, it was like a lot of trial and error. So I started in healthcare pharmaceuticals when I graduated from college and got my master's. And I did that because I had interned at that company. Honestly, I had needed a job and yeah. They were the only ones who would hire me. Obviously, we need healthcare pharmaceuticals, but I just always knew I needed something more creative and that would allow me to express myself. And then after that, that's when I moved to New York and then was working in fashion, which was awesome. But then that also started to kind of fall into the same pattern of like, I felt like I wasn't being challenged. And then I moved to LA and was working in fashion technology. Same sort of thing, you know, it was like got in the same sort of cycle of just feeling like I wasn't being challenged and I wasn't able to use my brain in the creative ways that I knew I was capable of. And then my husband, who's in film, he was like, you know, I think that you should try out the film industry. And then I did. And then here we are.
When you were in New York, is that when you met Wyatt?
That is when I met Wyatt Rogowski.
He's the second best editor I know.
Wait, who's the first? Oh my God. Wow. Dumb question, huh?
No. I'm actually.
All right. Wait, hold on. Stop for a second, Rick, because he's just going to keep going and firing and not give me a moment to ask a question.
Just in my defense, I have 9 million questions to ask you, and I'm trying to rip through them because I want to start getting to the meat here. But go on, Eric. Let's waste everyone's time with this question.
So I'm curious because you just referenced on numerous occasions about like the creativity aspect of wanting to. Is there something in your upbringing that pulls from, you know, in terms of creativity? Do you have any creative outlets when you were younger and growing up?
Yeah, no, that's what a wonderful question. I honestly what you just say.
he's cursing me.
You can't see now his head. His head is
now you're jealous. Okay, I get it.
Listen, we've already set up this podcast is my therapy session. I have so many insecurities. So when you say good question to him, and I'm the producer over here. Got it. Thanks.
Yeah.
But please go on. Creativity in your childhood.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I grew up constantly reading, constantly writing, drawing. Like, you know, I think we can all relate to this. In our day, it was very like TVs weren't the main focus. It was very much like doing things outside of technology, playing outside, being in nature. Yeah. So I've been creative my whole life, but I think I just like, oh, I never was able to understand how I was going to use that creativity. Yeah. Like, it wasn't like, you know, how some people are like, I know I'm going to be a drawer or like a painter or an artist. And they've just been doing that forever. For me, it was like, I knew that I had something inside of me. But what's really difficult is when you grow up in environments where you're not seeing those things that you want to be. That's why I think my entire career trajectory was trial and error, because everything that I tried, I had never seen anyone do that before. I'd never seen anyone do the things that I was trying to do besides on TV, which, you know, from being a young lady, a young girl in St. Louis, those things felt pretty unattainable. My parents weren't like pushing me to do the creative thing. They were pushing me to do the stable thing. And that's kind of what led me throughout that journey and kind of where I'm at.
That's right cool. Now. Well, good on you for continuing to try.
So you moved from New York to LA it's still to go, all right, I want to become a producer. Like, it's not the easiest path to take. Just go, all right, I want to be a producer. And then all of a sudden you have a hit Netflix show. Like, how did that happen? How did that, from the time you said, I'm going to do this to getting, let's say, that gig or any other gigs you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, to be totally honest with you, like, I have to give a lot of credit to the second best editor that you know, Rick, which is my husband, Wyatt. He always had an unwavering belief in me and belief in what I could do. And from the very beginning, he was like, I think you'd be an amazing producer. Like, I think you should really try that out. I think you should go down the path and see what that would look like. And I think the advantage that I have is when I did decide that I wanted to figure out what the producing would look like for me, I had already had a lot of work experience. So it wasn't like I was like a college student or like a 20, you know, no shade on the 22, 23 year olds who are producing and have been able to like skip all those steps. Love that for them. But like, I had already had very corporate experience. Like, pretty much, I think all of my previous careers really was the perfect matchup for me to then be able to do that job of being a producer. And also, like, let me be totally honest and transparent in saying it's not like I like quit my tech job and then became a producer. I quit my tech job before we even knew the pandemic was happening. So it was like January 2020, I quit my job and I was like, okay, cool. I have like a little bit of savings. I'm gonna like really dive into this producer thing. And I like was totally down to like start over. Like, I knew what the game was and I was down to play it. But then COVID happens. And then you're like, wow, like, I'm grown as hell trying to like figure out this new career path. Like, it was really scary. But at the same time, I was like, at the end of the day, like, there's never going to be a perfect time. So it's like, I started as a coordinator on a RIP Quibi, on a Quibi show, which obviously that show.
Eric, do you know what Quibi is? Right. People in the industry, it was such a blip.
I do remember that.
It was going to be these 10-minute films, and literally, they would just, it was what that you, I think you could flip it, your phone both ways, but the whole idea was you could watch while you're waiting for the bus. That's what they kept saying. That was their whole pitch.
That's what they called it. Quick bites. And it was like either movies or series. They put they got over $1 billion worth of funding for this thing.
I remember specifically you, Rick. I remember you talking about writing some scripts for some Quibis.
But what they did that I think was a problem, it's in hindsight, obviously, is they just took like the Most Dangerous Game with Chris Hemsworth. They shot the movie and then just put it in the 10-minute chunks. So you still, it wasn't like a normal break, and you weren't satisfied with only watching 10 minutes because you could do that with the movie anyways.
Right.
Go on. So you were working on a development project for that?
Well, it was a show that was, it was funded.
Oh, it's funded. Got it.
I was a cold reach out girl. Like, I would like be on all the listservs for like woman in film or, you know, woman of color and felt like all those different like emails, Facebook groups, like anyone that was looking for anything. And I just like did a cold reach out for like a completely separate project and then got in touch with the line producer for that. And then she was like, oh, so like this short film that you reached out to me about, that's later, but I have this Quibi thing and need a coordinator. Like, do you want to do that? And I'm like, I was like, absolutely. Cause I knew that was going to be my foot in the door. And I knew though, like had never, and I had like produced some other stuff on the side, like, you know, friends and stuff and all that on the side, but had never been like in an actual like corporate structure for film. So I just was so pumped to be able to prove myself and really just be able to get in there and understand the lay of the land. So then we did that Quibi show. It was a show about like unhoused individuals in LA and their relationship with their pets.
Wow. Okay.
But obviously no one got to see it because, you know.
Well, didn't Quibi sell off a lot of their shows for scraps? Like, can't you go on like Roku and stuff and watch it?
Yeah, I don't know if ours ever made it.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, okay. I know they were in talks with that. I don't know what ended up happening with that. So then after that show, I got really lucky because then we were in starting to film with that same production company, which is Amy Berg's production company called Disarming Films. She was starting to do the Evan Rachel Wood documentary that's now on HBO that was about her relationship and also just like the monster that Marilyn Manson is.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was immediately brought onto that, which I was so happy for, because as a freelancer, like, you're very gig to gig. So the fact that, like, Quibi was going downhill and I was able to, like, hop on this other project, like, immediately after, I was so grateful for that opportunity. So because I then was brought on to this HBO show, it was a super, super small team. And the producer at the time, she was actually leaving that project to then go on to work as an executive at another production company. And she was like, you know, I know you're a coordinator, but, like, I think you're ready to be a production manager. So literally within, like, I started that project, the homeless pets one, in, like, July, August as a coordinator, and then was promoted to production manager within, like, less than 6 months.
One of the things about the industry is it's hard to find good, competent people. So when you do, you steal them, you take them in, and you don't want anyone else to have them and stuff. Yeah. So it seemed like that, like, a perfect storm of that Quibi thing. The fact that Quibi went away maybe have helped you to move over. So I'm sure they were like, the only way to keep you is to keep promoting.
And it's a testament to exactly what you referenced, which was the skill set that you had built prior to heading into some of those things. Guaranteed, there were a ton of people around you that were so grateful that you had what you had, you know, to be able to look at, like, oh my God, she's totally got her shit together. This is amazing. Like, we need to, you know, boop, boop, boop. That doesn't surprise me at all based on what you were talking about, some of your previous experiences.
Yeah, I think it was the perfect storm of that situation. And then to get to the Pepsi of it all, because truly Pepsi for my career is what was able to take me to the next level. So I had this HBO show that I was on. This was right after the Quibi one. So we're still in 2020 at this point. So literally it's like 2020 was crazy. I quit my job. I have no job. I'm literally living off of unemployment. That's how I'm surviving. Then I get the Quibi job. 6 months later, a few months later, I'm now on the HBO show. So all this is literally within a year. And then one of my good friends, Jeremiah Murphy, who at the time, he's now a director, but at the time he was like a story producer, co-executive producer. He had worked on The Curse of Von Dutch with North of Now on Hulu. And he was brought on to then do the Pepsi show. And he reached out to me and was like, hey, so like that director I've been telling you about, Andrew Renzi, he's doing this like huge McMillian style Pepsi show that's going to be on Netflix. And like, I would love to see if I could get you in there, like as a producer or something like that. And I was like, oh my God, I was like, that opportunity would be amazing. I will do whatever it takes. Long story short, I end up having conversations with Boardwalk. They're the production company that ran production services. I end up talking to Renzi. He's the creator and the director of the project. And I end up getting hired as a field producer, which I was like, so excited about, because that was yet another promotion, you know? So it's like within less than a year, I go from coordinator, production manager, and then to field producer. And then when we wrap that, you know, I knew I had been doing more than field producer work. Like, though I was in the field, I was also helping in post. I was helping our archival. I was doing a bunch of different stuff. And when I was wrapping, I reached out to them and I was like, I think I deserve a producer credit.
Yeah.
And they were like, we agree. And then they gave me a producer credit. Nice. So all literally within like less than a year and a half, I was able to get to that point. And then that's kind of what led me to where we're at now.
You're still with that same company.
Well, and what's crazy is I was a freelancer, but now I'm like a full-time staff employee at North of Now, which is the company that did Pepsi, Where's My Jet, and all of that. So yeah, I work for North of Now full-time now.
Do you know who Theo James is?
Of course I know Theo. And please, I want to shout out Theo. Please watch his new show on Netflix called The Gentleman. He's killing it. I'm so proud of him. Theo is amazing.
So I was like, this actor is phenomenal. So I was watching The Gentleman.
Yeah, so good, right?
It's one of the best series I've ever seen.
I agree.
He is one of those people, I've never seen him, or maybe I've seen him before, but I just didn't know it. But he's one of those people where you're like, oh, when you say you can watch this guy read the dictionary and it's going to be entertaining, he's that guy. His demeanor and everything about it. So I was like, what else has this guy been in? And I'm scrolling through his credits. I was like, executive producer on Pepsi, Where's My Jet? So tell him I got a man crush on him.
Shout out to Theo for sure.
So one of the things that that I loved about Pepsi, Where's My Jet, is I grew up in that time period. So I literally remember that commercial, watching that on TV, and thought it was the coolest thing. So to me, how can you kind of talk about, from your experience, the approach, especially because if you're a field producer, how do you keep it tonally like that? Number one, because it was it's somewhat of a serious subject that you, I mean, tongue in cheek serious, but you guys kept it comical, kept it funny. And then what were the kind of mandates that you had to work with in the field that gives you that flavor on every interview and the kind of craziness of all that?
Yeah. I mean,
was there a question in there that made sense, by the way?
Really great question.
Eric, you are now the second best podcaster on this show.
Amazing question.
Vivi, before you answer, I would just like to point out one thing that Rick said. I grew up in that time period. Let me correct you, Rick. We grew up in that time period. So you do have a co-host here.
But to that, he wasn't allowed to watch TV, and that's a fact.
I had to come to his house to watch the commercial. That's all.
What's really interesting, and like I think this speaks to two things. One, to Renzi's approach and like the way that he directs and creates these shows. Everything is super organic. So like it's not like when we were setting up these interviews and all of that we were like trying to make it seem a certain way. I think it was like John and Todd, who were the main characters of those stories, like we just allowed them to be their true authentic self. And I really think that a lot of that came through in the interviews and especially in the edit. I think for me, a lot of that came down to like really just making sure also that the vibes on set were correct. Like that's really one of my biggest things as a producer, especially when I'm in the field. I definitely want to make sure that we all feel like we have a synergy. Like we're all working together. No one's like, I'm feeling like I'm higher up than you. And, you know, because all it takes is for that one asshole to show up and they're like cancer. And then they it starts to trickle throughout the rest of the shoot. And then next thing you know, everyone has like a badass attitude. And like, it's really one of those things where like the energy on set was so positive. And I really feel like that came through in the filmmaking. And also so much of like the tone and the style and all of that, like, obviously, yes, a lot of that was like Renzi's brainchild. But then like going back to your second favorite editor, Rick, like a lot of that was like Wyatt's genius pace. Yeah. Like seriously, like he's truly so great at what he does.
I know.
Like
he's so irritating. Really,
and you want to know what though? Like I will say that's, I've always been a super motivated person, but like Wyatt was the first relationship I had ever been with where I truly like looked up to him.
So on Pepsi, you were in the field, but then you said you started to do the edit. What was your position there?
Yeah, so for me, it was more like giving notes on cuts, doing that sort of thing. Yeah, which for me, like I love that. Like that's something that like I find to be really fun. But it's hard when you live with the editor. You have to like have some separation. Some, you know, it's like I could walk into the edit room and I'm seeing things happen in real time and I want to be impartial to that. But for me, it was like, it was more, I was really functioning. Like anytime there was a gap or someone needed help with something, I wanted to make sure that I was available to help. So Jeremiah, the co-EP who I was speaking about, he would do what they call like paper edits and like kind of be able to take some of what's happening in the edit and then translating a lot of that on paper, like in a very specific way. So like I would help him with that. Sometimes our archival producer, because really it was just her putting all this stuff together. We went through a big moment where like the way that the archival was, and the archival, by the way, to give a little bit more context is like, you know, either photo, video clips. I mean, the commercial itself is a piece of archival and she's gathering all this information, scouring the internet, going to different resources. It's a lot of information. But the way all of that was organized in the Avid, which is an editing system, it wasn't in a way that was conducive to the editors being able to easily be able to find it. But they didn't have anyone to be able to like figure out how that should be organized. Right. That's where I come in. I love organization. I love doing that sort of stuff. And Lauren, the archival producer, she just, because she's too busy being able to like actually do the treasure hunting, and she's doing the EDLs and all that other stuff. So that's where I came in and helped her and kind of figured out a way to be able to organize all of that. So it's like, it's not like I was doing one thing specifically, like I was really working across the project in many different ways wherever I could, you know, be the most helpful.
How do you approach watching something that you work on and giving notes? Like, meaning just peeling back the curtain of, you probably have things in your head like, oh, that's while you're on set, that's going to make it into the cut or whatever. And when you're given notes, and it may or may not work, how do you sit there and go, as an audience member, with all this back knowledge of how we got to this moment right here, how do you approach note taking or note giving?
Honestly, and what's interesting also is I give a lot of notes on stuff that's like also not even my project. For instance, like why it's working on a project, they did a screening where they wanted notes. I give notes based off like what I want to watch mm-hmm. because I think I have good taste personally. And mm-hmm. even with the stuff that I know that we've shot and like I have knowledge of that sometimes I think should or should not be in there. I'm always doing it through the lens of like, I think about myself when I sit down on my couch and I'm scrolling through Netflix, HBO, Hulu, any, you know, I have all the apps. And if I'm not hooked within the first, like for me, my attention span and my time, like very, very, very little, just like the two of you. And if we're not hooked and like, I, you know, I'm not feeling distracted or wanting to put, you know, pull up my phone in like the first few minutes, like that's a red flag, you know? So it's like, I'm yeah. always just thinking about like, that's how so many people decide what it is that they're going to watch. So it's like, how are we hooking people in within the first like 5 minutes? Because if we're not doing that, because platforms like Netflix, they a lot of their success is based on completion rate. So like a lot of times it's not so much like, oh, how many people watched it? Like, of course, that's a part of it. But it's like the reason Pepsi was so successful was because so many people watch that entire series from beginning to end.
Is it
hold on, because I want to lead into my Netflix side of that. So your friend had the number one show, The Gentleman, on Netflix, and then the number two show was ours.
Yeah, so good.
One of the things is, so I finally got to see how they do their analytics and ratings, and they do it by the first 2 minutes, then it goes by how many hours you watch. And so, because we were like, oh, is there any way we can beat The Gentleman? And the answer is no, because they released 8 episodes. I think it was 8 episodes.
Yeah.
So, you know, most people, if it's good enough, you're going to binge watch them. And that happened with Pepsi. I sat with Caden, my oldest. I was like, you want to see a blast from my past? And we were going to watch one episode. We ended up devouring it. And then it just spawned so many conversations. But to that point, like the other thing too, is like, I now watch, like I'm sure every person does now, I have my phone literally out while I have the TV on, so I can always be checking. And the thing about Pepsi, neither Caden or I checked our phone during the whole thing.
Thank you for that.
Was there anything in that process, like with your notes or anything that you felt needed to be in there that you really had to fight for?
No, I really think that because there's just so, you know, it's one of those stories that like, luckily it was a pretty like straightforward story of like how John and Todd met. John goes on this journey with Todd. They go after the jet. Boom. You know what I'm saying? So like, I think, you know, kind of answering both of you guys' questions, like another thing for me that like is super important is like, how are we going to make this documentary not feel like every other documentary that we've already watched? Because like, there's definitely a formula.
There's a formula, but you achieve that. It does not feel like anything. I put it in my top 5 documentaries of all time.
Wow.
That's how, like, it goes The Jinx.
You see they're coming out with a part 2?
Oh, really?
Wait, what's your number 2?
Pepsi.
Wait, what's number 3?
Well, there's this one about Tommy Unger. Do you know him?
Oh, yeah. Have you seen that one?
Well, I haven't seen that one, actually.
It's called Far Out Isn't Far Enough. It was nominated for a Producers Guild Award. It lost.
who put that together, Rick?
Brad and I.
Oh, nice. Okay, I'll check it out.
Rick's point about the Pepsi, I thoroughly enjoyed, we touched on this before you came on, I thoroughly enjoyed the nostalgia aspect, that like the way that was built in there. over the last few different shows that I've seen that had some nostalgia, it's been really interesting for me mentally how much that has like brought up things inside of me that were completely unexpected about like that time or like, and there's a lot of things that are tied into that, but just even watching like the old rotary phones being used and having like, and mentally like remembering like what that was like and like the games I used to play with that kind of stuff. And like, it just took me back to so many things. So I loved the nostalgia.
I had the sweatshirt or t-shirt that he was wearing. Literally, to the young kid. He looked like me when I was a kid. I had the hat like that. I had the same exact 100%. Shirt.
Wow. Yes. I came on. Yeah. I when it came on, I went, oh my God, Rick had that shirt.
Well, and you know, what's really interesting, I think why Pepsi did so well. And I think also why a lot of other, like I'd even say Quiet on Set is doing really well too on HBO. It's like they're one where, you know, kind of they expose some of the executives or whatever at Nickelodeon. I think because it's like, you know, it was like, that was a different time. It almost felt like a more simpler time in our lives. And it's like you going back and talking about the rotary phone and also like the, remember when you used to print stuff and you'd have tear the edges.
Dot matrix printers.
Yeah. You know, so it's like, I feel like that's what really hit for a lot of people within our generation was like, it just was like, things were different back then. Before it was like all about the television, the laptop, the cell phone, you know, like all these things that are like keeping us directed into screens. Like it was a simpler time where it felt like it was more about human connection and helping each other and having more faith in humanity. You know what I mean? Yep.
And all that comes across. So kudos to you guys for doing that. Cause it's also a David versus Goliath story.
Absolutely.
You know, and one thing, cause I want to transition here. So just going back to one of my favorite docs, have you seen Don't Fuck with Cats?
Of course, one of my favorite docs for sure.
One of the best, right? And it does what every good doc should do. It makes you feel something. And then I watched last night The Antisocial Network. That is infuriating from the word go. And it's infuriating because you already know the end of the story, every frame leading up to it. Tell us everything.
I honestly, it was one of those projects where as we were making it, I was learning so much. So like the filmmakers, Giorgio and Arthur, they co-directed this project together. This was almost like the precursor to another film that they did, which I highly recommend you guys watch and viewers watch as well, called Feels Good Man. And it's about how Pepe the Frog became a white supremacy symbol.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes. Wow. Yes.
Yeah. So, and it's very like different, but in the very similar, gorgeous animation, graphics, like sort of vibe for the documentary. Mm-hmm. And so it was one of those where it was like, as we were creating the documentary, like I was learning so much because I didn't understand how deep this shit went. Like, to be honest, like, it's like, you just, for me, my knowledge kind of started at like, oh, there's like this dark web stuff. And then like these crazy QAnon people. Oh my God. And then these like insane people storm the Capitol. But it's like, that's what I think is so important and so interesting about Antisocial Network. It's like, no. We need to talk about like, but how did we get here? And it's so interesting because you think about as you watch that. And the reason it's called the Antisocial Network, it's a play off of like the social dilemma, like that documentary. Because think about how so many things, they start off innocent and good and people that have like decent intentions. And then all it takes is for the, you know, just the internet hate machine, as they call it, to do what it does best. And it gets some bad actors in there and then it completely morphs into something different. And it's like, we've seen that happen with obviously 4chan, 8chan, all the chans, Instagram, TikTok, you know what I'm saying? Like Facebook.
Everything. And the thing is it's the easiest thing in the world to fall into that because you could take the most benign thing. Who's better? Michael Jordan or LeBron James? And it's going to turn into angry people yelling about angry things. Yes. And it'll turn from that into, well, you're a MAGA or you're a liberal, you know, and it's like, we're talking about Jordan versus LeBron here. What are we doing here? And it's funny because before you got on, we were talking about the Antisocial Network And I was like, I'm going to say something that shouldn't be controversial, is it's probably not good to storm the Capitol. But somehow that's controversial even to say that, as Eric was saying, because he wanted to go really bad to January 6th.
Yeah, no, Eric, you're about to say something.
This just goes, this is in line with, you know, what does that really say about human nature, right? In terms of what you're saying about the bad actors, and then it just turns into the machine, right? Of some of those bad things. I was really taken back. I watched the Antisocial Network with my wife, Carrie. I was really taken back at how uncomfortable it made me when I saw the footage at the convention where they were doing...
all the Hitler
where
stuff?
They were like, quite literally, I watched that and I was trying to... I was like, okay, I could see... being in that space and then feeling like you're part of something, and maybe you're not an actual terrible person, but you think this is kind of funny, or you're going along with whatever the whole thing. But then there's just like, oh my God, this is so awful. Like it literally made me sick to my stomach watching that play out and take place. I was like, how could this be? It was, it just,
even if you're doing it as a joke, it's now in a popular film.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like you are in a popular film doing that. It's just like, God, you just don't, it's so stupid. So one of the cool things about like our industry is, you know, you're slogging through the mud to get it done, and then you get it done, yeah, and then you get to celebrate it. So tell us about the Southwest experience.
Yeah. So my first time going to South by Southwest was for the Antisocial Network. It was really great. I think for me, like, of course, the festival was awesome, but like I really enjoyed getting to know Austin. Austin was one of those places that, like, I'm not even joking you, probably a week or two before we found out that we got in, I was saying to Wyatt, I'm like, I really want to go to Austin. I just like don't know when. And like I clearly must have been manifesting, because then like a week later we got in and we were like, we're going, you know, and then we texted Rick like, hey, we're going to be in Austin. And you're like, oh yeah, you should come stay with us. Oh yeah, you need a car? I got you. I'm like, oh, what is going on?
No asking, by the way. It's, all right, you're staying with us from this day to this day. Here's the car. What else do you need? You know, I think my favorite part of that weekend was looking at houses with you guys. Are you going to break any news here? Did you guys find one you liked?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I still am telling people the story of us looking at houses. And I just tell people so we can all feel bad, like all our friends who own houses.
Yeah.
It's crazy. We like went and looked at a 4,000 plus square foot home for like nothing compared to like
a quarter of what they're paying.
It's like one of those where you're just like, make it make sense, you know, especially with just all the inflation and all that other stuff going up. But yeah, listen, like every state has their shit. California, we definitely have our own sack of shit. Absolutely. But like, this is where we love being. This is like the Mecca for hot. I mean, like me and Wyatt's life completely changed once we moved out here.
Yeah.
And we love it. But we now know that we have a place to come visit whenever we come back to Austin. So
going back to the Antisocial Network, you talked about how when you were on it, you were learning a lot of those things. I consider myself pretty tied into some of the technology, you know, like tech world. And some of this, I had no idea, like some of those things that were pieced together with that whole thing. So I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And I watched it with, Carrie, and she was doing the same thing. She's like, I didn't know anything about any of this. I was like, I knew about Anonymous. I knew about QAnon. I knew about these pieces, but I had zero clue that all that stuff, there was absolutely fascinating the way they got pulled together.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like, I hope this movie allows people the opportunity to be more intentional about how they are spending their time online and how they were interacting with other people. Like, I used to be huge on Instagram and Facebook and all that, but it's like my pages are still active, but I do not actively use those platforms at all anymore, because honestly, for me personally, I just feel their time suck. I get anxiety when I get on there, because it's like it's everything is, it's just almost like bombardment of information. Also, it's like, I have a bunch of friends that are like pregnant right now, and like, I want to be pregnant one day. And you say that and your phone listens to you, and I log into Instagram and it's like all just like baby. It's like, stop it.
Yeah. So the whole idea of this podcast is defined moments of memories, and it could be personal, professional, anything that you want. Has there been a defining moment in your life that we always say it's where you could have gone left, but you went right, and that changed the trajectory of your life? Do you have a moment like that?
Yeah. For me, it was moving to New York when I was living in St. Louis. I was like, I knew I didn't want to stay in St. Louis, but I wasn't sure where I wanted to go. I actually thought I maybe wanted to go to Texas. But then I went to Texas and I was like, hell nah, no offense. it just like wasn't for me. But I remember a friend of mine, his name's Tyler. He invited me to New York for New Year's. And I was like, and I'd never been in New York. So, and New York was one of those places where I was like, I will never move to New York. Like, it's too expensive. I hear everybody, you know, when you're like, you have that Midwest mindset and all the stuff you see on TV, you just like take that as fact. So it was like that. So I was like, yeah, I'll go visit New York. I'm sure I'll hate it. I'm not even joking you. Right when I stepped foot out of that bus, getting on a bus to go to wherever our hotel was in Brooklyn, that was the first time in my entire life that I ever felt like I was supposed to be somewhere.
Wow.
Like I literally had this overwhelming feeling of like, I feel like I'm a New Yorker. I can't believe I spent so much of my life saying I would never visit or never, never live in a place like that. And then ever since then, that's when I went on the journey to figuring out how to move to New York. And even when I like got a job and was like, I'm going to move to New York, my parents, they were like, this is not a good job. You should not go. And I was like, I know it's not a great job, but like, I just have to be in New York. I have to be there.
Walk me through that process. So you come back to St. Louis and you're like, all right, the wheels are turning. How do I get to New York? Or was there a period where you're like, ah, that's too far away. It'll never happen.
I knew I needed to be in New York. The only thing that I was like on the fence about is if I feel this way about New York, maybe I should also visit LA so I could see what I think about LA. Like I never thought I would be a big city girl.
Smart.
Yeah. But then I was like, I am. So I ended up visiting LA and I was like, absolutely not. LA is not what it looks like on TV. It's dirty. Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. Like I don't want to like New York is it. And then I got a job at a place that's no longer around. It's a styling company called Trunk Club, which was Nordstrom owned Trunk Club at the time. And yeah, my parents, they were like, really, they like told me like, you should not take that job. You should not move out. Like we recommend that you don't move out there. Like, please, like they were like begging me, please don't do it. And I was like, I'm going. So like, you guys can either help me get my shit together and pack it up into this car and help get me to New York. Like, or I'm going to do it on my own. Like I'm going to literally just move out there on my own. So, and they decided to help me. So
what do your parents think of your career path now?
Oh, they're so proud of me. Yeah. Oh, that's they good. Didn't, yeah, they didn't really understand the journey. I think was something that like, it took them a bit to, you know, they're like, listen, my parents have had the same job their entire career. So they are very like, oh, look at that pup. Oh, hi, Pop.
Yeah, she just busted in. So.
Oh, so cute. Yeah, my parents are all about stability. Like, if it were up to them at that time, I would have stayed at my healthcare pharmaceuticals company until right now.
Yeah.
All right, Vivian, we've taken enough of your time. I can't thank you enough for doing this.
Okay, well, this is great. I really appreciate you guys even thinking of me to be on such a wonderful platform with two really wonderful guys that are being able to spread all of this really, really great knowledge with the world. I'm so proud of you both. So thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you
really
for coming. It's incredible. You're doing awesome stuff. I can't wait to see what's next.
Thank you guys. I appreciate it.
She was awesome. It would have been cool if you would have let me get a word in.
Dude, I will admit. Yeah, you got to fight for that. You got
to
fight for the mic.
Swear to God, you're the worst, dude. You are the absolute worst. And then when I have to fight for it, then it makes it awkward. You're the worst, man.
How much of this do you think I'm going to edit out?
Is it attention? Is it because you need the attention?
I got a lot of questions.
It's the ego. You got like, it has to be me asking the question. I have questions too, man.
How do you want to end this?
Usually it ends with, are we done?